From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, mosquitoes, why they bite us, and why those bites itch and sometimes kill. We talk with Andrew Spielman, author of the new book, Mosquito. He's a tropical disease expert with the Harvard School of Public Health, and he studied mosquito infestations around the world. Also, we talk with actor Jonathan Pryce. He's now starring in the London production of My Fair Lady, and he plays Gustav Mahler in the new film, Bride of the Wind. He won a Tony for his role in Miss Saigon and has co-starred in such films as Glengarry Glen Ross, Brazil, and the Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal appeals court in Denver has refused any further delay in the execution of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. An attorney for McVeigh says his client won't pursue any further appeals. The three judges said McVeigh failed to show any substantial grounds for putting off his death, which is scheduled to take place on Monday. McVeigh's lawyers had asked for more time to review thousands of pages of FBI documents that were turned over to the defense in recent weeks. They said they believed the documents contained information that could have helped during McVeigh's trial for the bombing that left 168 people dead. Judge Richard Mach ruled yesterday that there was nothing in the documents that would cast doubt on McVeigh's guilt. President Bush has signed into law a $1.3 trillion tax cut, giving his administration its biggest legislative victory since he took office. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
There was a feeling of celebration in the East Room of the White House as the president prepared to put his signature on the tax cut he's been talking about since last year's campaign. It is the biggest tax cut the country has seen since Ronald Reagan was president.
A year ago, tax relief was said to be a political impossibility. 6 months ago, it was supposed to be a political liability. Today, it becomes reality.
The tax cut is spread out over 10 years. It reduces income tax rates, but many of its provisions take years before they go into effect. Most immediate is the mailing of $300 and $600 rebate checks to taxpayers, with the goal of giving the economy a boost. Critics of the tax bill say it will eat up the surplus and that its biggest beneficiaries are the wealthiest Americans. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Federal officials told a House subcommittee today that the volume of potentially dangerous, counterfeit, or illegal prescription drugs entering the United States through the mail has overwhelmed the system to protect the public. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
Almost all the prescription drugs that enter the U.S. via the mail violate current legal requirements, the Customs Service told the Commerce Committee's Oversight Subcommittee. Yet in a pilot project in California, the Food and Drug Administration was able to inspect less than 12% of suspicious packages set aside by customs officials. And FDA officials said that thanks to the internet, the number of packages containing drugs is growing geometrically, up to as many as 2 million per year. Of the packages detained in California, some contained drugs that had been specifically rejected for FDA approval. Others contained drugs that had been approved previously but withdrawn because of dangerous side effects, and some contained drugs that could not be identified at all. Julie Rovner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 20 points to close at 11,090 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 46 points, or 2%. This is NPR News. Exit polls in Britain show Prime Minister Tony Blair's Labour Party winning an overwhelming victory in today's elections. The polls showed Labour candidates winning more than 400 seats in the 659-seat House of Commons. That would ensure Blair a second term in office. The election was marred by a shooting at a polling place in Northern Ireland. A gunman wounded two policemen outside the polling place, shooting one in the arm and one in the shoulder. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the attack. Vaccination begins tomorrow for nearly 6,000 students following an outbreak of bacterial meningitis in northeast Ohio. So far, two teenagers have died in the outbreak. A third is seriously ill. Karen Schaefer reports from member station WCPN in Cleveland.
Health officials say they plan to vaccinate 5,800 students and staff members from six high schools in the Alliance area southeast of Cleveland. Ohio Department of Health spokesperson Cheryl Lufitz says the widespread vaccination program exceeds guidelines recommended by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Because the high school population students are very social, they have a lot of activities together, they socialize and fraternize with students from other schools, we took a broader approach, a more conservative approach, and looked at the six area high schools in order to provide the vaccinations.
Thousands of residents have already received antibiotics, but the pills only last a couple of days. Vaccinations offer protection for from 3 to 5 years. For NPR News, I'm Karen Schaefer in Cleveland.
Recapping our top story at this hour, an attorney for Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh says his client will not appeal a 3-judge panel's decision not to allow further delays in his execution. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, featuring the Unlimited Advantage, brokerage service that lets investors consult, plan, invest, and bank. 1-800-MERRILL or askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mosquito bites can be a nuisance, but in some parts of the world, mosquito bites can kill you after infecting you with encephalitis, yellow fever, or dengue. Public health experts in the U.S. are tracking the spread of the mosquito-borne West Nile virus, which started showing up in New York City in 1999. So far, close to 90 people in the U.S. have been infected with the virus. Nearly 10 have died. My guest, Andrew Spielman, has been studying mosquitoes for about 50 years. He's a senior investigator of tropical diseases at the Harvard School of Public Health and is the author of the new book, Mosquito. Before we get to West Nile virus, let's hear how and why the mosquito sucks your blood. Only the female mosquito feeds on blood. She needs it to make eggs. In fact, each meal will help her make 200 to 300 eggs. A mosquito may probe your skin as many as 20 times before biting. I asked what she's looking for.
Well, she's like a blind nurse. What she's looking for is a vein, of course, and she can't see it. So she's essentially stabbing at random. And after about 20 random stabs, if she fails to actually find a blood meal, then she, gives up and tries someplace else. But the whole process is extremely interesting. These random inward stabs are aimed at nicking a blood vessel and forming a pool of blood in the skin. A mosquito has sensors on the end of her mouth parts, and if a pool of blood forms, she can taste it. As she pulls back at the end of each of those 15 to 20 insertions of her mouth parts. And once the mouth parts taste blood, she ceases this in-and-out movement and starts drinking. The result of that is to impale the blood vessel over the ends of her mouth parts.
Now, each time that she's stabbing, looking for a vessel, is that another bite, or do you only get a bite when she actually finds the vessel and sucks your blood?
Well, the bite is when she lands and inserts her mouth parts. That starts the biting process. And then in the course of searching for blood, there are some 15 to 20 surges of her mouth parts through the skin. Oh, it all takes about a minute or a minute and a half, these 15 or 20 surges. Well, and each bite is the includes all of this activity.
Something that you point out is that after a mosquito has bitten you, she probably has ingested several times her body weight in your blood. And
yes,
that's going to make it difficult for her to fly, which means what? That you can kill her more easily?
Well, this makes a very vulnerable point in the life cycle of a mosquito. That hour after she's taken a meal of blood until her body is able to rid itself of most of the water that she ingested, she'll sit on a nearby wall, on a nearby vertical surface, and urinate for about an hour. And only then is she light enough to move around very easily.
Huh, I never thought that they were urinating on the wall. Is that detectable?
Oh, yeah. If you look carefully, you can see the pink-tinged urine that the female is excreting. And absolutely.
So she's excreting the fluid from your blood, basically.
Mm-hmm. And there's often a little bit of blood mixed in with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is she doing? What is she putting into your skin that's going to make you itch and swell?
Well, there is a series of enzymes that she secretes into the skin. Each inward movement of her mouth parts results in a secretion of this salivary fluid that contains a series of enzymes. One of them is a pyrase that stops platelets from aggregating, and that helps the flow of blood if indeed she's fortunate enough to have nicked a blood vessel.
So it's like
on
she's
that inward plunge.
It's like she's putting in an anti-clotting device into your blood.
Right. And the enzymes and other material that she injects with each inward surge is these are antigenic, and that's what causes the immune reaction in a person's skin, the sensitivity reaction, that results in itching and a small amount of pain.
What does antigenic mean?
Well, it's a chemical that is foreign in a person's skin. So this would be a mosquito chemical that would be in a person's skin that would not actually be recognized as something that ought to be there. So a person's immune reaction would react against this foreign substance, this material that is called an antigen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Spielman. He's an entomologist who's a senior investigator in tropical diseases at Harvard School of Public Health. He's also the author of the new book, Mosquito. People on the East Coast now are particularly worried about West Nile virus, which was first found in parts of the East Coast in 1999. You say West Nile virus is the kind of mosquito-borne virus that is more likely to breed in urban places. Why is that?
Well, the mosquito that is the main vector of West Nile virus, that is, it's the main carrier of it between vertebrate hosts, is an urban mosquito. It's called the house mosquito, and it's only found in abundance in really urban areas. It breeds only in filthy water of the sort that occurs in a street drain or an abandoned swimming pool or the downspout of a roof gutter that's not draining well. It's that sort of an extremely artificial, extremely urban sort of a site that breeds these mosquitoes. And these mosquitoes, of course, are essential for the transmission of this particular virus.
So if you've got stagnant water that fits that description near your house, you'd be doing the right thing to get rid of it.
Oh, yeah. Indeed, you would.
Where has West Nile virus been spotted so far this year?
Well, the first isolations this year were in New Jersey. And at last, a reading of my email system, there were 11 isolates from New Jersey. One isolate as far south as Maryland, and several others in southern New England and New York.
An isolate means?
In this case, it means a dead bird with a virus in it that we could isolate and actually demonstrate was a virus of a certain sort. So it's a technical term used in that way. It would also be used for designating a pool of mosquitoes that contained virus.
Mm-hmm. What are the symptoms of West Nile virus?
There's a fever initially and extreme muscle weakness, and there may be respiratory difficulty. There's a headache. And it's that sort of a thing. The most characteristic sign of infection is this extreme muscle weakness.
So it's like an extreme version of the flu.
Well, much more than that, in that one loses control over his muscles and is unable to move effectively.
Oh, that is worse. So what precautions would you advise people to take?
Well, if there is any obvious source of these mosquitoes around the house, they very definitely ought to be eliminated, which means an abandoned hot tub, an abandoned bird bath, a downspout that is not draining well, other pools of water around the house, larger pools of water, not just a water bottle or something. Always be something that would hold at least a gallon of water. That ought to be eliminated if it's seen. Automobile tires, abandoned automobile tires that are lying around under a tree are also sources of danger in this regard. So in terms of individual personal protection, one ought to avoid mosquito bites at night. And air conditioning is a wonderful a way of doing that. The windows will be closed, and mosquitoes will be unlikely to enter a house if it's air conditioned. Otherwise, screens are reasonably effective. Although these mosquitoes are notorious for working their way into small openings in the screens. They can often jam themselves through the holes in a fairly coarse screen. So it's a matter of looking out, especially at night, that you're not being exposed to the bites of these mosquitoes. In general, though, one ought to avoid all mosquito bites. Most mosquitoes feed in the late afternoon and early morning. Those are not the main vectors of this virus, but there is a certain chance that the virus may be in these other mosquitoes. And I would recommend that one avoid any unnecessary mosquito bites. The use of DEET, a repellent with DEET in it, that's spelled D-E-E-T, all capital letters, is an excellent a way of protecting oneself from mosquitoes. Long pants and a shirt with long sleeves would also be helpful.
So I don't want to unnecessarily scare people. Do you expect that a lot of people will get West Nile virus this year, or do you expect even if it spreads further that there will still be very few people who actually are sickened by it?
Well, I think that the virus will surely spread geographically, but the issue of intensity of transmission in any site is complete unknown. We have no idea whether transmission will be intense anywhere. It may act as it does in Europe, just sort of waxing and waning and appearing now and then, affecting, sickening 100 people or more, and then disappearing for years in terms of human illness. Of course, the virus is still there in nature, but it's not causing this sort of damage that we sometimes see.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Spielman, and he is with the Harvard School of Public Health, where he's a senior investigator in tropical diseases. He's an entomologist and author of the new book called Mosquito. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll hear more news about the mosquito. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest Andrew Spielman is the author of the new book, Mosquito. What is the worst mosquito infestation you've seen during your mosquito investigations around the world?
Well, I've been in houses in Africa where you could rub your hand across the wall of a bedroom, and it was like a cloud of mosquitoes would emerge from under your hand. Absolutely a dense a layer of mosquitoes over the wall, all filled with blood. It's interesting that in China, the graves of Confucius and his heirs are vulnerable to mosquito infestations because they're stone-lined. The actual grave is not filled with earth. There's a stone tablet over the graves, thousands of them, and many of them fill up with water. I was there on one occasion and was amazed at the absolute cloud of mosquitoes that faced me, in that particular site.
At that site in Africa where the wall was just covered with mosquitoes, what did you do there to help get rid of the mosquitoes?
Well, this was Egypt in the Nile Delta. Nothing very much. Those were the common house mosquitoes, and they were an intractable problem under those conditions. I did nothing.
So people just lived that way?
Yes.
And were these mosquitoes likely to carry illness?
Yes, indeed.
So why was there nothing that you could do in this particular area of Egypt that you were discussing?
This was the area that was affected by the Aswan Dam that went in Upper Egypt. This, of course, is in Lower Egypt. But what happened there was that it stabilized the water table, and people were building their homes right at the water's edge. Prior to Aswan Dam, that there was an annual cycle of flooding, which meant that you couldn't build your house in a poorly drained location. But once Aswan went in, the land would be usable for construction that was less and less well-drained. And there was just water everywhere.
So I guess you can't expect to live in a place like that and escape.
Right. That is the burden that you pay for building a house in a location like that.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Andrew Spielman. He's an entomologist who's written a new book called Mosquito. He's a senior investigator in tropical diseases with the Harvard School of Public Health. You know how sometimes two people will be sleeping in the same room and one of them is bitten like crazy by mosquitoes and the other doesn't get a bite? Are some people more flavorful or attractive to mosquitoes than others?
Oh, very much so. Many experiments have been done along these lines. People have attempted to understand what it is about certain people that makes them more attractive to mosquitoes than other people. And we don't really know. Some investigators in Holland working with certain mosquitoes, that is, those mosquitoes of Africa that feed almost exclusively on people. And these investigators learned that it was the odor of human feet that was acting as the stimulus for mosquitoes biting. Being Dutch, they also tried Limburger cheese and found that it was equally attractive.
Well, here's some bad news. You say that typically if there's a mosquito around, what you're going to do is wave your arms to try to wave the mosquito away. But
oh, yes.
What does that do?
Motion registers on their little nervous systems and alerts them that an interesting object is nearby. So I wouldn't wave my arms. I wouldn't swat at mosquitoes unless you were absolutely certain that that was the only mosquito in the vicinity.
Otherwise, you're saying, over here, I'm over here.
Right.
Well, I've got one last question for you. Say you're in bed at home or in a hotel and you hear a mosquito buzzing around. What are you going to do?
Well, I would kill it, even though I'd be absolutely sure that the risk was so infinitesimally small. I find myself waking up in the middle of the night with that a note of high C in my ears and making a fool out of myself, chasing that mosquito, calling myself an idiot all the while. But that is what I would do. I would chase it down and kill it for emotional reasons.
Because they're your adversary?
Well, in this case, yeah.
Now, is it?
It's the unknown. Yeah, it's the unknown. You always wonder if that bite is loaded. I guess.
Is it always high C that a mosquito buzzes at?
In that neighborhood, different species have different frequencies and different overtones, but that's generally the range of the sound that they make.
And are you good enough that you can tell by the buzz what kind of mosquito is hovering around you?
Yeah, a little. I can tell the common house mosquito from the yellow fever mosquito and from certain Anopheles mosquitoes. Yeah, I can do that.
One more thing before you go. I am more alarmed having just spoken with you than I was before.
Oh, my.
Do you want to leave me in that state or do you want to reassure me?
No, not at all. I think that individual risk is very, very small. We shouldn't overrate the importance of this as a threat to our individual health. What is important is the numbers, not the rate. So there may be 20 or 30 people affected in a city of 10 million, but the risk to the individual is extremely small.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us about mosquitoes. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Spielman is the author of the new book, Mosquito. He's a senior investigator of tropical disease at the Harvard School of Public Health. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Jonathan Pryce. He's now starring in the London production of My Fair Lady, and he plays Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. He co-starred in the films Tomorrow Never Dies, Glengarry Glen Ross, and Brazil, and won a Tony for his performance in Miss Saigon.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There are several ways you may know my guest, Jonathan Pryce. If you like Bond films, you'll recognize him as the villain in Tomorrow Never Dies. If you're like Mamet, you'll know Pryce as a gullible customer in the film adaptation of Glengarry Glen Ross. Pryce won a Tony for his portrayal as a repellent pimp in Miss Saigon. He starred in the cable movie Barbarians at the Gate, but TV viewers may know him best for his Infinity car commercials. Pryce's other films include Brazil, Carrington, and Evita. Now Pryce is starring in a revival of My Fair Lady in London's West End, and he plays composer and conductor Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. The film revolves around musician Alma Mahler and her tumultuous relationship with Gustav and several other brilliant men, including the architect Walter Gropius and the novelist Franz Werfel. I asked Jonathan Pryce what he needed to know about Gustav Mahler before portraying him.
What I've found when I've played kind of biographical roles in the past is that there's a danger of having too much knowledge, and because ultimately all you have is the script, and that's all the audience are going to receive. But there's a lot to read about Mahler, a lot to find out about him. And he was a hugely complex character, but sadly, not for the film, but sadly for me, it's one episode in the film. The film is essentially about Alma Mahler and her life and lives with the various men in her life. And Mahler takes up the first part of the film. I would love to have gone on. I'd love the film to be called Gustav or something. It'd gone on, Bridegroom of the Wind. And gone on to explore in depth, you know, much more about Mahler. Because there are so many things that are just hinted at and dismissed in a sentence or so. You get the information over and then you move on. And it's essentially about his emotional life with Alma. There's another film there that I'd like to make.
You have a love scene with Sarah Winter, who plays Alma Mahler. This is before she's married to Mahler.
Mm-hmm. But
I think this love scene is a good example of how something in movie love scenes has shifted. Now, you're both under the blankets in this, so we don't get to see your bodies, but we can see by your movements that you're actually having, the characters are having sexual intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
You could just tell that from the motions. What do you think of having to do that in love scenes now? I've seen this a lot in movies now. You know what I mean? That kind of like up and down motion. You could tell what's supposed to be happening.
Oh, that thing.
Yes.
The up and down thing.
The up and down thing, yes.
Well, it was in... It's very integral to the scene and very important. I don't know how to talk about it, other than saying the scene is written in a way that Mahler, the first part of the lovemaking scene, he's incapable of, or is shown to have been incapable of making love to her. And it tells you something about his character and his personality. And then in the second half of the scene, when Alma takes control, then they're able to make love, and that's really what it's about, is about being able to... The second part of the scene is about being able to fulfil it. I think the way we did it was rather tasteful and rather romantic, and, you know, unless you're going to cut away to the old scene of the crashing waves on the beach or the train
going
entering
the tunnel,
into the
right.
tunnel, I don't know what you do. Yeah. Well, no, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm, okay. Jonathan Pryce is my guest, and he's now starring in My Fair Lady in London. And he's also starring in the new movie Bride of the Wind about Alma Mahler. He plays Gustav Mahler. Your breakthrough musical, which was also the musical that a lot of people in the States were introduced to you through, was Miss Saigon,
mm-hmm.
In which you played a pimp selling girls on the street. And... you played the role in London, then took the role to the States. When you took to the role to the States, it was a big controversy because Asian American actors protested that an Asian American should have the role because it's a Vietnamese role, half Vietnamese, half French. And Actors Equity agreed, so there was a protest against you getting the role. You almost weren't allowed to play it. I'm wondering if you ever wanted to give up. I mean, you know, let's face it, there's so few roles for Asian American actors, and particularly when Miss Saigon came out, color colorblind casting hadn't progressed to even the point that it is today.
Well, I think the issue of Miss Saigon promoted and helped the issue of colorblind casting. It was, it works both ways in every way. You can't, if you demand that people of any role should, any ethnic background should be able to play any role, then that covers, black, white, whatever. There were very positive things came out of those arguments, and one was that people were made aware that there was a problem and that minority actors weren't being seen for the roles they should be seen, and that very positive things came out of the Miss Saigon issue.
Did it make you more sensitive to colorblind casting?
I'd always been sensitive to colorblind casting. I'd worked in multiracial companies in Liverpool, Nottingham, and Stratford, so it wasn't a problem for me. The company in London, the Miss Saigon company, was a multiracial cast. There were people of all nationalities playing all kinds of roles. It wasn't a Caucasian cast, if there was a frustration, it was at the time, it was that our case wasn't being understood or represented properly. And so I never really felt a lot of frustration of it because I knew the validity of our case, really.
Well, why don't we hear a song from the cast recording of Miss Saigon? And this is you singing in your role as a pimp. The song is called What a Waste. And you're selling girls in the song. Let's hear it.
What a waste to pay for my keep, from rounding up sheep to fleece here in Bangkok. I'm disgraced. I can't get ahead. There's nothing as dead as peace here in Bangkok. Come on, guys, check my girls, huh? 10 cents an hour, and I stand all day. You like what you see, huh? Yeah. I could sell Kim for 10 times my pay. Guys, here, guys. If you're looking for fun, original sin. If you wanna put out, then you gotta come in.
Girls, I got girls, gorgeous girls, very nice girls.
Gee, isn't Bangkok really neat?
I got girls.
The things they're selling on the street.
Girls.
Fresh dog, if that's what you'd enjoy.
Worth the price.
A girl, or if you want a boy.
Come to me.
Get out of it, will ya?
Fast drink is free.
Oh. Don't be a lump, you can hump for a small extra fee.
Jonathan Pryce, words like slimy and repellent were used to describe your character in this musical. It must have been an interesting character to play.
It was, yes, yeah. I'd never done anything like this before, and a completely sung-through role was very exciting and challenging to do.
Let me contrast your role of the aggressive pimp to a role that you played in David Mamet's film adaptation of his play, Glengarry Glen Ross. And this is a play about salesmen who are sharks. They're very smarmy, fast talkers. They sell real estate that probably isn't worth a dime, but they're selling it for a lot of money to people who aren't smart enough to kind of pick up on the scam. And you're one of those unsuspecting people. You've bought some land from Al Pacino. But in this scene, you've come in to say that you've spoken to your wife and she insists that you back out of the deal. Of course, Al Pacino has no intention of letting you back out of the deal. So here's Pacino trying to get away from you.
I'll call you this evening. Jim, I'm sorry. I had to come all the way in. I'm sorry. Monday lunch.
We really have to go.
All right, Monday.
She called the consumer, the attorney, the attorney general. They said we have 3 days.
Who'd she call?
The attorney. It was some consumer office.
Why'd she do that, Jim?
I don't know. No, but they said we have 3 days. They said we got 3 days, yeah.
3 days?
To.
No, I don't know. Tell me.
What, to change our minds?
Of course you have. 3 days.
Well, so we can't talk Monday.
Monday, you saw my book. Jim, I can't. You saw my book. I can't.
Yeah, but we have to before Monday to get our money back.
3 business days, they mean. 3 business days.
Yeah, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
I don't understand.
That's what they are, they're 3 business days. Look, if we wait till Monday, my time limit runs out.
You don't count Saturday.
I'm not.
I'm saying, you don't include Saturday in 3 days. It's not a business day.
I am not counting it. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, so it would have elapsed.
What would have elapsed?
If we wait till Monday, it would have elapsed.
When did you write the check?
Yesterday.
What was yesterday?
Tuesday.
And when was that check cashed?
I don't know.
Well, what was the earliest that it could have been cashed?
I don't know.
Today? Which in any case it was not, as there was something on the agreement I wanted to go over with you, in any case.
It wasn't cashed.
I just phoned downtown. It's on their desk.
That's Jonathan Pryce and Al Pacino in a scene from David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross. Jonathan Pryce, what's it like to be the person who is so afraid and unassertive that he can barely speak in a movie that's just populated with fast talkers?
It's quite a relief, really. The irony is I filmed that during the day while I was doing Miss Saigon, so at night I was playing the sleazy pimp and the fast-talking hustler, and during the day being which is just about what I had enough energy to do, be the wimp who was trying to slide out of things, yeah.
That's funny.
We had a good time with great actors, and we rehearsed it as if it were a stage play. We rehearsed at length for a couple of weeks or so. It was good.
My guest is actor Jonathan Pryce. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Pryce. He's starring in the London revival of My Fair Lady, and he plays composer and conductor Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. Let's talk about your life a little bit. You grew up in Wales. Would you describe the area that you're from?
It was quite a thriving, semi-industrial area of North Wales. There were the hills where the farmers lived and the plateau where I lived, and then there was the down on the coast and in the valleys where the industry was centred, and it's a lot of coal mines, and now it's a very depressed area, like much of Wales, because industry has moved out, the coal mines have closed down. It's now very beautiful and green, but it's because nothing happens there.
Your parents ran a grocery store?
Mm-hmm, yeah. My father was originally a coal miner, and then he met my mother, and they opened a small grocery shop in a village.
Did you have to work in the store?
I didn't have to. I did when my father was older and he was ill, and I used to help him out a little. We used to go out on the... he drove a mobile shop, a van that you sold groceries from the back of the van around the housing estates and things. So I went out on that and made a few deliveries with him and occasionally worked in the shop, yeah.
Did doing that expose you to different types of people that maybe you were able to draw on later for characterizations?
I don't remember. I remember all the characters, and there were a lot of characters at the time who came into the shop. They were people from the kind of previous generation. They seem from another. When I think back on them now, they were very much another world. It was the pre-war and immediate post-war world of the women who worked in the textile mills and the paper mills that were near the shop. It was a very poor area, so there was lots of characters, I remember. Most of them owed us money. That's what I remember most.
They owed you money, did you say?
Yeah, so my father survived once the supermarkets opened in the town. He survived on giving credit to all the people who'd spent their money at the supermarkets, and then they needed groceries towards the end of the week, which they would... get on credit, you know, from my father, and then you'd have to go and collect the money from them.
Did you have to do that to go and collect the money?
Yeah, yeah. I still remember those people who still owe us money, so...
That's an awful position to be in, though, isn't it?
Oh, it was horrible. It wasn't a great time. No, not for my father, anyway. He was a very popular man in the village prior to this, and, you know, he had a very nice life, and then... I don't know if it means anything to you, but the advent of supermarkets and large scale, you know, stores, it killed off a lot of the small businesses, and it certainly ruined my father's way of life.
Your father was also, I think, attacked in the store, and that resulted in a stroke, and he died, I think, just a couple of years after that.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you at the time of the attack?
I was in my late 20s. I was... when he was attacked initially, I was directing in the theatre in Liverpool, which was not very far away from where we lived. And he died, as you say, about 2 years later, actually while I was in New York doing Comedians, he died. But that informed, I mean, I managed to work out a lot of things about my father through various plays that I did, especially Comedians, which... was about ostensibly a relationship between a young man and an older teacher. It was the kind of father-son relationship that I was never really capable of and never was able to, because while we were doing it and my father saw it, that's when he had the stroke and lost his... we never spoke again. He lost his power of speech. But it informed all kinds of things. The way I played Hamlet, for instance, was informed by my feelings about my father. And
how?
Well, it was mainly to do with the portrayal of the ghost of your father. And we wanted to find a way of interpreting the ghost, the appearance of the father, as shocking as it to a modern audience as it would have been when it was originally performed. This was 1980. The Exorcist was still strong in people's minds, and I explored ways of depicting possession and people who spoke in tongues. And I thought I'd seen my father after he died. A couple of times he appeared to me, and it was, I think, nothing more than wish fulfillment, that desire to see someone who was gone, and it was impossible. And I sort of molded this to Hamlet, that he was so racked with guilt not doing anything to avenge his father's death, which is what I did at the time my father died, you know, albeit through a stroke. It was initiated by a violent act. And I had felt no sense of that I wanted to revenge his death. Hamlet didn't revenge his father's death, and Hamlet, racked with guilt about this, conjured up the image of his father who then told him how he died. And this was in a fit of possession, and the voice of the father came from within me. So I played the ghost, very like Linda Blair in The Exorcist, speaking in this strange belly voice, possessed by the ghost of your father.
You said that when your father was killed, you had no interest in trying to avenge his death.
Well, I wouldn't say it was no interest, but it was something I sublimated within myself. My sisters felt very angry, and... other people in the community felt very angry and wanted to deal violently with the young man who'd done it. But I suppose I was a little more sanguine about it at the time and felt helpless and nothing I could really do about it.
So there was someone who stood trial for the attack?
Yes, oh yes, yeah. He was 16, and so he received a kind of youth custody sentence for about 6 months.
What happens to you psychologically when you feel you're actually like working through one of the most emotionally potent experiences of your life? You know, that you're working through that in this play.
Well, you save money on therapy, I think. it becomes almost a celebration of that aspect of your life and the aspect, you know, how I felt about my father. And it was a very positive way of dealing with things. I didn't do it in order to deal positively with it or thought of it at the time as therapy, but in retrospect it was the best thing I could have done.
I'm thinking though that if a director doesn't like what you're doing, it would be particularly difficult and particularly painful to change, because you're not only playing Hamlet, you're acting out your deepest feelings about your father. Well, so you have so much personally on the line there.
Yeah, well, the director was Richard Eyre, who was a personal friend. I worked with him for quite a number of productions, worked in his company at Nottingham for a year or so. He knew me very well, and it was this was something we worked out together. I didn't go to him and say, this is how I want to approach Hamlet. It was something that evolved in discussions prior to rehearsals and during rehearsals. And, you know, if it hadn't been valid, neither of us would have wished to have pursued it, but it seemed very right at the time.
My guest is actor Jonathan Pryce. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Pryce. He plays Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. At the same time that you're starring in the new movie Bride of the Wind, you're starring in London in a West End production of My Fair Lady as Professor Henry Higgins. Just for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with the story of My Fair Lady, Professor Henry Higgins decides to take a poor woman selling flowers in the street and make her into a proper lady. And the way he goes about this is to, like, you know, not only train her in etiquette, but to teach her to speak proper English and, you know, to lose her Cockney accent. And, of course, The Rain in Spain falls mainly on the plane is the song in which he teaches her how to speak proper English. I'm wondering what kind of proper accent you use, you know, because Henry Higgins has to speak the most proper English. Is that an English that's natural to you, or are you speaking a different English than you usually
speak?
Well,
I'm Welsh, so my basic accent is, was, before I went to drama school, was I had a Welsh accent. And I've learned how to speak English, as it were. But my version of received pronunciation, RP, as it's called here. According to Patsy Rodenberg, who is the voice coach and the voice expert at the National Theatre, where we're doing the play, she's the recording she's listened to of the time, which is the early 1900s. My accent is pretty much how they spoke. It's not the accent I'm talking with now. It's a little more proper. But it's not what people think good English is, which came about through the 20s and 30s, that very clipped sort of Noel Coward version of English. It's a much more straightforward version. Vowel sounds are correct. I don't, in my natural speaking voice, all the time have correct vowel sounds, because whereas English people say grass, I say grass. And if people say bath, I say bath. And that's much to the amusement of my children, who think I speak strangely at times, as they've been brought up in England.
Patsy Rodenberg, the speech and dialect expert who you mentioned, has been a guest on our show, and we're great admirers of her. What advice did she give you?
She said, "You're doing just fine."
No, I guess that's the best advice of all.
I went to her, actually, because she hadn't said anything to me, and I said, "Patsy, is it okay what I'm doing?" She said, "No, it's perfect." So I didn't push it. That was fine for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tonight you're performing in My Fair Lady on the West End.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to take care of yourself in a different way when you've got nightly performances?
Yeah, you do. I don't do... this is the most talking I'll do of a day. I don't do very much. The show is quite long. It's 3.25 hours. So I'm kind of out of my dressing room at 11:15 at night, and there ain't a lot I want to do then. I get home, everyone's gone to bed, so I'm usually... I sit up reading until about 2 in the morning.
What are you reading?
Newspapers. I spend hours reading the newspaper. We've got the general election this week, so there's acres of political reporting to do. It's quite amusing at the moment. But we have the vote on Thursday. We have a different system to you. I don't know if you know, because when our voting system, whoever gets the most votes becomes prime minister.
Right.
So, I don't know, call us old-fashioned. There you go.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Jonathan Pryce recorded earlier this week. He plays composer and conductor Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. Pryce is also starring in the London revival of My Fair Lady. We'll close with him singing a song from the show, from a recording that he made before the show for the 1998 CD Hey Mr. Producer, paying tribute to producer Cameron Mackintosh.
Damn, 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 damn! I've grown accustomed to her face. It almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune. She whistles night and noon. Her smiles, her frowns, her ups, her downs are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in. I was supremely independent and content before we met. Surely I could always be that way again. And yet, I've grown accustomed to her looks, accustomed to her voice, accustomed to her face.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Bob Purdick. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at SaabUSA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates, a novel by Tom Robbins, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Sedaris reads from and talks about his best-selling book, Me Talk Pretty One Day. It's just out in paperback. And we hear from actor Alan Cumming. He co-wrote, co-directed, and co-stars in the new film, The Anniversary Party. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.